SF Signal, episode 40, interview with Paul Kemp. This is the SF Signal podcast, as powered by the Functional Nerds. My name is Patrick Hester. I'm an author, a blogger, and an all-around functional nerd, no matter what Ottinger says. And longtime listeners to the podcast will know that whenever I say that, it usually means that Ottinger's going to be on, and he is on with this episode, number 40, I believe. He is sitting down with Fictioneer, Paul S. Kemp, that's his own word, Fictioneer, to discuss Forgotten Realms, Star Wars, and a bunch of other stuff that he has written. I may or may not chime in. You guys know me. I'm pretty quiet. I just kind of sit back and let other people run these interviews. Yeah, right. But you don't want to hear me prattle on. You want to hear the interview with Paul Kemp. So here you go. John Ottinger, Paul Kemp, and maybe me once in a while kind of chiming in. Here you go. And tonight we have a very special guest with us, author Paul Kemp, and he's going to be chatting with Mr. John Ottinger. John, why don't you go ahead and take it away?
All right. Thanks, Patrick. For those who don't know, Paul Kemp is a Forgotten Realms author as well as an author of Star Wars novels. Most of his work is in shared worlds, but he's also and in that he's earned some New York Times bestsellers. He's also a father and a lawyer. So, Paul, let's just start off with an easy question. How are your twin boys doing?
They're doing great, actually. We just they're just coming off of their winter break, so they were off for a week. During that period, both of them had a fever, and both of them were vomiting, so it really, really was a great vacation. But now that is over, they're back to school, and things are going along just fine.
Oh, well, that's good to hear.
Thanks for asking, though. I appreciate it.
Oh, sure.
You've got
sure.
a daughter, don't you, John?
Actually, no, I don't. I have no children, unless you consider my dog to be a child. No, I have not been blessed that way.
So John has no kids, but his wife is still raising a husband.
That's exactly right. One of my questions for you is, you work full-time as a lawyer, and you write full-time, basically. How do you balance those careers?
Well, you know, I always say, and I know it's a bit of a cliche, but I would say we sort of make time for the things that we really love and that we want to do. So for me, those are really three things, and that's family, my legal job, which pays most of the bills, and the writing work, which I love and pays a smaller fraction of the bills. So, you know, I write on lunch, I write in the evenings. A lot of times, instead of sitting here talking with you guys, I'd be drinking a scotch and slapping down a few hundred words. And, you know, you just juggle it that way. You know, and in the meantime, you throw in a workout when you can, you take your wife out to eat when you can, and so on. And that's really all it comes down to. It's just time management. Now, the truth is, when I started writing, boy, you know, I mean, writing 1,000 words in a day would have been hard. I mean, your writer's toolkit is, at least for me, it was quite limited at the outset. So you really struggled over things that today I don't struggle with. So today, putting 1,000 words down might take an hour and a half, 2 hours of, and I could put down 1,000 very good words, whereas before, I mean, it might take me all day, and I would just be struggling the whole time trying to put out that kind of volume. I know some writers do a lot more than that, some do a lot less, it varies for writers, but just for me, it's gotten a lot easier as I've gotten more skilled, and the toolbox has gotten broader.
Okay, so how many books do you have published now, at this point?
Let me think here.
If only there was some sort of website that we could go to and look that up.
Yeah, you know, this would be one of those things you could just sort of pull, right? You know, you just know. I think I have 11 novels, I think, that are out, excluding anthologies. I have short stories that have appeared. I've got two more coming this year and at least one coming out next year, and I'm hoping for two next year.
Well, and the one that's coming out, I think, in March of this year is Deceived, right? That's a new Star Wars novel?
Yes, Deceived comes out March 22nd, and then Riptide, the sequel to my first Star Wars novel, Cross Current, comes out in September, That was originally scheduled for a July release, but they pushed it back for a variety of reasons.
You know, I read that as Coruscant.
Say that one more time.
I read that as Coruscant. I was looking at that going, Star Wars Coruscant.
No, Cross Current.
Gotcha. See, I told you I'd sit back and be quiet.
Yeah, right.
I'm a huge Star Wars nerd, so.
You are?
Yeah, I just actually got to chat with John
Jackson Miller.
Yes, John Jackson Miller.
Yeah, I'm going to see him at the Chicago Expo here, and geez, that's going to be about 2 weeks too. He and I are going to do a panel there with one of the Del Rey editors.
Okay.
During the Entertainment Expo.
Okay, this is what I need you to do for me. When you see him, walk up to him and say, "Gosh, you know, I remember when comic books were 45 cents."
I'll do it. Done.
Please,
done.
Please do. And then he'll get it and he'll get a kick out of it. Anyway,
you got it, brother.
I apologize, John. I have sidetracked yet another of your interviews.
What? Sidetrack nothing. It's always great to just have a good conversation between fans of science fiction and fantasy. That's just good times.
Yes.
Okay.
So what's it like writing in the Star Wars milieu?
You know, it's in a word, it's three words? It's pretty freaking cool. Star Wars is, it's an international cultural touchstone. I mean, everybody knows Star Wars and it filters into popular media and you can't turn on the TV and see a sitcom that doesn't have some kind of Star Wars reference. But so, in that regard, it's just awesome. You're being able to participate in this thing that's just so much larger than yourself, and it's very cool. On the other hand, it's kind of humbling. And when I did the first novel, frankly, it was a little bit unnerving because I thought, geez, I know the fans really, really love the setting and have certain kinds of expectations, and I wanted to write the kind of novel I wanted to write. But I also wanted to meet those expectations. So, that's a juggling act that can put some pressure on yourself about that in a way that I never felt when it came to the realms, my Forgotten Realms fiction. People there are passionate about the setting, but that setting is so wide open that I always felt like there was enormous room for different kinds of styles and tones and so on. In Star Wars, I feel like there's still a fair amount of room, and that room is ever increasing as Del Rey sort of allows the authors to explore different kinds of themes and tones. But at least at the outset, particularly when I was doing my first novel, I didn't feel like there was quite as much. And I just want to satisfy the fans and write a book that they found satisfying. So I think based on the critical reception that I was able to do that, at least for the most part. So I'm pleased by that.
Yeah, and I noticed that your characters tend to be sort of gray. They're neither wholly good nor wholly bad.
Yes.
And I assume that was what you were trying to do with your Star Wars novels, which really doesn't exist too much in that universe.
Yeah, I did want to do that, John. You're exactly right. I've always found, as a writers always have kind of a certain comfort zone, and it's good to get out of that comfort zone, frankly, from time to time. But for me, the kinds of characters that I enjoy writing about are the kinds of characters who don't comfortably fit into a typical kind of label. As you mentioned, it's not clearly a good guy, it's not clearly a bad guy, protagonist, antagonist. When you fiddle around with those roles a little bit, I think there's at least the possibility of surprising the reader. There's the possibility of provoking some interesting thoughts and conversations about the character's behavior, the kinds of moral stances they take, the way that they resolve the conflict in the plot, and so on. So, yeah, I do. That's the way I like to do it. And Del Rey was good enough to allow me to do that with Cross Current. One of the things I did when I talked with my editor there about writing the novel was to indicate to them that I really wanted to write about characters that were not the sort of the big name Skywalker Solo characters, and ideally characters that I either invent entirely myself or that have been written about almost not at all. And in the case of Jaden Kaur, his existence in the Star Wars Expanded Universe consists essentially of having been the kind of the avatar for the old Jedi Academy video game from way, way back when. So really no history there, no, particular psychological makeup and all of that. So basically it was really nice because I got a kind of a shell of a character who existed in Star Wars lore, but whose personality, whose history, whose internal dramatic conflict hadn't been developed at all. So I was able to do that entirely on my own. And then, of course, all the ancillary characters are mine. So, they were cool with that. I was cool with that. And then they were cool with my kind of, as you say, taking an approach where it's not entirely clear who's a good guy and a bad guy at particular points in the novel.
And you know what? Just to throw this out there, those Jedi Academy games were the best damned games.
They were cool games. Yeah, I have to agree.
And why is the guy on the cover of Riptide that's supposed to be Jaden, why does that look like Heath Ledger with a haircut?
It does look like he, but here's the funny thing, and I didn't realize that this was coming out, that they changed the cover. And the cover today, it just came out. I just saw it on Twitter while I was waiting for you guys to call. I was taking a look, and there were a bunch of tweets about it. The cover's totally different now, and the Jaden doesn't look... He still has the sunken eyes and the narrow face and the short hair and the goatee, but he looks considerably different. But otherwise, I agree. I thought he put the face paint on.
Yeah. Weird.
Yeah. Well, is that approach you mentioned, if I can speak properly, kind of what you did with Deceived? Because, Deceived is based on the new Old Republic massively multiplayer online game.
Correct.
And, of course, you had to work with the fact that they'd already released a trailer.
Uh-huh.
And you had to work within that and then build a story based on beginning with those events. Is that...
Well, I didn't have to do that. It sort of worked out more like this. The trailer came out. It was just a promotion for the video game. And let's, while we're talking about video games being awesome, I don't know how the Old Republic's going to be. I expect it's going to be awesome, but the trailer is freaking awesome. So that came out. And after that, I was approached by Del Rey. They said, listen, we want someone to write a hardcover novel that relates to the game. Do you want to do that? I said, sure, I'd love to do that. Depending upon... what kind of story you want me to tell? Am I looking at really a lot of constraints here? How's that all going to work? And they said, here's all we want. We want a novel that features Darth Malgus, who's the star of the cinematic trailer. And I said, well, that's easy. I can handle that. What information do you have about Malgus? So they sent me some backstory that they had about him. And they said, okay, tell us what kind of story you want to tell. Do you want to set something before the events of the game? Do you want to set something during the events of the game? Do you want to go way back to what amounts to his adolescence and childhood and show up to say hi or that kind of thing?
Stop walking around your basement.
I'm not. Am I breaking up again still?
You did, yeah.
Ah, jeez, man. Sorry about that.
So we heard, do you want an adolescent story?
Yeah, they said, look, you can tell any kind of story you want. It just has to feature Malgus. So after looking at the materials that they sent about Malgus's background, having a look at the trailer, thinking about the kind of story I wanted to tell, I decided to tell what I think is a really, it's a relatively tight story that covers a period of a few days that occurs immediately before the, not immediately before, but very near the beginning of the timeline of the game. So, I did that in part because I wanted to avoid any need to make the story consistent with events that might happen in the game, because I don't know that all of those were ironed out at the time, and in any event, I wanted to minimize the kinds of restraints that I had to deal with. And then I also wanted to incorporate the events from the trailer, just because I was so taken with it. I thought it was so cool. I wanted to work that in.
As far as the game is concerned, are they doing that smart or are they doing that stupid? And by that, I mean, are they doing Windows only or are they going to do like Blizzard and have it cross-platform?
John, I have no idea. It's just, I don't have any...
I was just curious.
No, if I knew, I'd tell you. I know nothing about the game development other than what's been publicly released and so on.
Interesting.
Well, I'd like to shift gears away from Star Wars and talk more about your Realms fiction and what you do with that. I mean, your character that everybody loves is this anti-hero, Erebus Kale. And what is it that appeals to you about anti-heroes and writing anti-heroes of that kind?
Well, you know, it's a good question. I think that one of the themes that appeals to me strongly, personally, is redemption. It's just this idea that you can do bad things or be a bad guy and ultimately find redemption in some way. And the perfect vehicle for that in storytelling is, of course, an anti-hero. This is a guy who's dark, whose methods are questionable, whose moral code is at best, you know, we might consider it kind of self-serving utilitarian, but sometimes it moves into selfishness or evil. And but at the same time, you know, the sort of an iconic anti-hero also has lots of redeeming qualities. He might be, in the case of Kale, for example, he's very loyal to his friends and family. He has his own sort of peculiar sense of honor and so on. And his entire, you know, the story arc for him that runs the gamut of the books is this quest for his own, you know, personal salvation, if you will, just an attempt to redeem himself from the past that he kind of hates himself for in a way, but it's the past that has prepared him to solve the kinds of problems that he has to solve in the present. So, you know, exploring that theme of redemption is the reason that anti-heroes appeal to me.
That's fascinating. And of course, what goes along with that is the fact that a lot of your material is darker, maybe, in a word, grittier, I think is the word that's being bandied about right now. And I was curious to know, have you seen the essay by Leo Grin and all the stuff that's been going around about this nihilism and fantasy and all that?
I did. I read a bit of that, yes.
Have you formed an opinion as to the sort of just what's going on, that argument there?
Well, I mean, summarize the argument for him. Give me his thesis, your take on his thesis, and I'll give you my response to it. I mean, you know, my initial response to all that stuff, John, is often, and there's value in this. I don't want to come off as entirely dismissive, but writers and critics and so on are just so prone to this kind of navel-gazing that there are times it just, I mean, candidly, it just drives me freaking bananas. You know, there are times, you know, I mean, storytelling as a tool has enormous value. And I mean, in my view, its value comes from, and I don't want to get all kind of new agey and weird on you, but I mean, I think that storytelling is a vehicle by which sort of communicate with each other what it is to be human. And the language that we use ultimately is emotion. So to the extent books resonate emotionally with people in particular ways, it reinforces certain kinds of views of what it means to be a human being and interact with other human beings. And the particular vehicle, the genre and so on, doesn't matter a heck of a lot. And, you know, when I started to read that essay, I mean, it struck me so much as troll bait that I just passed on it entirely. So I didn't follow along when Joe Abercrombie filed a bunch of people sort of posted on it. I thought, you know, this is just one of those kind of navel-gazing exercises that I just don't want to get heavily involved in. I thought, you know, I'm comfortable with the value of storytelling as storytelling, and I'm not particularly interested in what one particular buffoon may think about, you know, a dark style as embodied by Abercrombie or me or anybody who tells stories like this.
Okay.
But that said, I'm happy to, you know, not feel like I've just sort of cut off that whole line of questioning. If you want to summarize, you know, this guy's view, I mean, I'm happy to respond to it if I haven't already.
No, I think you've pretty much responded to it. I mean, it's obvious that you understand kind of what he was doing. I mean, his basic thesis was that he misses this sort of hopeful, epic fantasy type of thing, which most people agree probably never actually existed. He says it existed in Tolkien and Howard, but a lot of people are arguing that, that's not the case at all.
I see. Well, you know, and this would I don't want to devolve into. Fair enough. Okay, if I've answered it, maybe we just leave it at that. But I think that the response that you just articulated that you know, maybe it didn't exist at all, or at the very least, the counter trend has always existed. That is, even if we agree that there is this sort of hopeful tendency in some aspect of fantasy, there's always been the counter trend that has reflected a kind of nihilism. Isn't the way I've said it would just be a kind of a different take on the themes explored in the kinds of stories that Abercrombie might write or that I might write. I'm not likening myself to Abercrombie. It's just if he happened to respond, and I knew that he responded. You know, when we talk about themes like redemption and so on, these are ultimately hopeful. It's just that the journey isn't always, you know, one filled with flowers and rainbows and unicorns.
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, I have found that to be the case. I mean, I like hopeful fantasy as much as the next guy, and I also enjoy work by you. I enjoy Abercrombie's books immensely, but I expect something different. You know, I expect the journey to be different when I read it.
It'll just think about Moorcock. You think about the whole Elric saga, at least getting through the Stormbringer. That's ultimately not a hopeful series of books. I mean, and it is as foundational as Tolkien to fantasy, I think. Or at least the modern fantasy, and you know that when we think about a writer like Moorcock and his Elric series that ends with Stormbringer, that's not ultimately a hopeful story. It reflects the counter trend. Even if we, as I mentioned before, if we assume that Tolkien represents this particular kind of thread in fantasy, a more hopeful, optimistic view, let's say, you know, Moorcock has existed essentially side by side throughout. It's just as foundational to the genre, and that Elric sequence, at least taken alone, the Elric sequence is not represents a counter trend to that. It's much more, you know, Moorcock is kind of the best genre. I mean, when I write my Heir of His Kill novels, that's kind of the vibe that I'm going for, not the Tolkien vibe, but I think it's just as valid and ultimately just as useful as a storytelling vehicle. It serves the purpose that I see for storytelling, which is this emotional connection with, ultimately, this emotional connection with readers.
Your stories, you want to get an emotional reaction from your readers, is what you're saying. Okay.
I do. I mean, I don't want to say that's the sole purpose. I just think that's one of the foundational purposes of storytelling is reinforcing what it is to be a human being. And one of the ways we do that is we sort of speak the language of emotion. You know, we see how the fictional characters respond to the kinds of hyper-realized events and hyper-realized emotions that occur in fiction that ordinarily don't occur in real life. And in that way, we sort of, I totally get that. Now, there are other purposes for fiction, obviously, and not the least of which, frankly, is just pure entertainment. But that's one of them. I think about speculative fiction. One of the other things that it does, I think one of its other big key purposes, and this is all based on my own experience, okay, so I'm not some lit crit, master's degree, PhD in literature or something. This is just my own experience as a writer and reader. But the other thing is it really, I think it, speculative fiction, science fiction, fantasy really frees the imagination of the reader. It gives this real sense of the possible, and that too has enormous value. I think for me, it was just when I started reading fantasy fiction, I mean, it was just awesome, man. I've seen the term bandied about before. This whole sort of sense of wonder, you know, for me, that's really what it was and what it did, and that by itself, that in and of itself, is of enormous value.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. I mean, that's what I get out of it every time I crack open a book, whether yours or anyone else's.
Well, so there you go.
Yeah, that's very true. Well, let's just move into something a little more lighthearted, let's say. And you still play Dungeons & Dragons, right? When you can find
I do.
Time.
Yes, I do. I don't play as much as I used to because all my gamer buddies, you know, unfortunately, we're not all... you know, college students anymore with essentially no responsibility. So it's been very difficult in the last few months to get the group together. But yes, I do still play.
You know, you don't have to get the people together. There is this cool little thing that we're using tonight to record this podcast called Skype. And I know people who keep their Dungeons & Dragons groups together playing by using Skype.
Well, do you know, I think, Patrick, that we're going to move in that direction because I've got, because of work, a lot of my gamer buddies, I've been playing with these guys for 20, 25 years. They're around the country now. Just work tag. I've got one friend who's been in New York three months. Another one is thinking of moving to California and all that. And just today, in fact, the one of the fellows who's local sent me a link about a virtual tabletop, and I didn't look at it yet, but I suspect it incorporates Skype and all that. I'm with you, man. I think that's the way we're going to have to go.
It's especially cool for the Dungeon Master who can just make shit up and say, oh, no, I rolled this. You're dead.
Hey, suck it, losers.
You don't have to buy the barrier anymore. I forget what they call that. You know, the Dungeon Master would always put it up.
That was the DM screen, yes.
DM screen, that's it.
I still have
that's
one.
It. Oh, that's hilarious.
I also have a 100-sided die.
Nice.
It's about the size of a golf ball.
That's insane.
Now, do you use that for your percentile rolls, though? Because the distribution curve is not the same.
You were supposed to use that for everything. Yep, it was a 100-sided die.
All right, well, there you go.
My word. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah, don't get us started talking about dice, man.
I don't think we're geeking out totally. You're like, oh, yeah, you know, I got 100-sided. You know, I once had this 30-sided die.
Man, you remember the little cheap plastic ones that came in Dungeons & Dragons? Then you go to the game store, and you find that's like the first time you go into one of these game stores. Like, I went into Game Preserve, which is in Fresno, California. And you walk into the Game Preserve, and suddenly you realize, they have better dice.
Yeah, you get those dice that after like five rolls, they're round now.
Yes.
And they just won't stop. You roll them, it's off the table, onto the floor, into the corner. You're like, geez, oh, Pete's, man.
And then you find you can actually buy dice that match.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Fancy. Yeah. Fancy.
Fancy schmancy. Metal.
Yep.
Bowl. You can rock and roll on the dice, man.
It was awesome.
All right, John, so we were talking about writing.
Yeah, well, anyway, one thing I've always wondered is, you know, I played a little bit of Dungeons & Dragons in high school and never was
so
able
to. So you
want
a D&D geek, really?
What's that?
As geeked out as you are now, and I mean that as a compliment, digging on the fantasy lit and the sci-fi and all that, you weren't a D&D geek, no kidding.
I wanted to be. Okay. I desperately wanted to be part of that crowd.
We played every day at lunch. Every day.
Yeah.
In the library at high school, we played.
Did you really?
We would gather a crowd. I mean, there would be people gathered around us because we were playing Dungeons & Dragons.
See, when I played in high school, I had my gaming friends, and then I had, you know, at the time what I thought were the cool friends. And nary the twain did meet. It was always just, you know, I had these sort of, it was like a secret life I had where I would go and I was playing war games like Panzer Leader and Squad Leader and that and D&D. And then I had the other group of guys who, I don't do that stuff.
No,
I look back and then I go, geez, that's just ridiculous. But seemed very important.
Fresno, California, you know, you'd get like 110, 115 degree summers. And, you know, when we would start getting hot like that, the last thing you wanted to do would be sitting outside. And so we would commandeer the library.
Nice.
And we would just take over, like, this one little section of the library. And everybody that we knew would just kind of come and sit there and watch. It was like a spectator sport.
See, this goes to what we discussed earlier, which is free in the imagination, man. Gaming the same way.
Yep.
Same. I mean, it's collaborative storytelling. Same deal. You just incorporate dice for randomness. But
yes, and it was kind of funny because my friends all said, "Here's the Dungeon Master's books. We don't want to learn it. You have to learn it."
Ah, you were the leader.
So that's how I got that. So, John, what was your question about Dungeons & Dragons? I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, you know, I played in high school and all that, and it was interesting hearing you talk about, you know, playing as an adult and everything, because I really like to get back into that. I mean, you were saying how, you know, that's geek cred, and you know, I would love to be able to find a group around me that I could play with and do
I'll bet you there's 10
more than likely.
Yeah,
of course they may all be high schoolers.
No, I know a lot of adults are still playing. What you need to do, you need to find your local con, John. Find your local convention, and I guarantee you they'll have a game room, and you can meet people and get into that.
That's probably the way.
Yeah, that's right. I did a guest of honor gig at UConn in Ann Arbor, and they did the celebrity gaming, right, which is silly because I mean I'm not a celebrity obviously, but we did game. You know, some people gamed with me. I was just a player, but it was cool. And you know, they were all adults and into it, and not like weirdly into it, but into it for fun. It was cool. Mm-hmm.
Here in Denver, we have Mile High Con in October. And it's a literary con, but there's also a very strong RP presence. Mm-hmm. A lot of role players, a lot of people playing the games. So I would be willing to bet, John, you just need to find something local like that. Or totally. You know what? Even what's your comic book store locally?
I think the local one is about an hour away. Mm. So yeah,
what you do is you go on a Saturday and you just go up there and you check the place out and you ask them, and I'll be willing to bet you they could point you in the direction.
More than likely. That's good advice.
Mm-hmm.
So Paul, have you ever like created a character though that just completely flopped when you were playing?
No. I actually, do you mean like mechanically flop, like it was just not a very good, you know, in terms of combat or whatever he was built to do, or do you mean, you know, in concept it was just kind of weak and silly?
Either or. I mean, it depends on which one best applies.
Okay. I'm not a big time power gamer, but I usually create, almost all my characters are competent. You know, D&D is ultimately, there's usually, I shouldn't say this, there's probably some exceptions, but with almost all groups, everything ultimately evolves to combat. You kill people, you take their stuff. So your guy needs to be a decent combatant, and almost all my guys are at least decent. Sometimes they're really good, sometimes they're just okay. The concepts, though, I think are always really solid. So, you know, on the whole, no. I don't think I've ever had a guy who's just flopped. Unfortunately, I mostly DM. So I don't often get to create characters and play them. I have, you know, I have some fond memories of characters I played years and years ago. In fact, and John, you'll know, Jack Fleet from the Erebus Kale stories, the first trilogy, is actually based on a character that I created in a campaign years and years and years ago.
I didn't know that. Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah. No, so that was one of the times I actually got to play, as opposed to DM. These days, I exclusively DM. When we play, I'm running it. So
here's the DM's frustration: is when you've created something really really cool, and you're just waiting for somebody to turn left, and they keep going straight.
Oh yeah, you know, and the thing with I've gotten, and I'm sure you are too, Patrick, if you've done this a lot, but you get very good at sort of ad-libbing things on your feet. And this is a very good exercise, incidentally, for writers. I mean, if you're DMing, I feel like I'm just really totally geeking out on this phone call. if you're DMing a role-playing game, as I mentioned, it's really just collaborative storytelling. But since you're sort of the DM, you are in some sense this kind of omniscient narrator. And it's a really good kind of storytelling skill builder as you do that. So when somebody left, I've gotten very good at changing essentially everything on the fly such that they ultimately experience whatever the hell it was that I designed for them to experience when they turned left, notwithstanding the fact that they went straight. And they never know that I've changed anything. So, you know, when you get used to that, sometimes when you're writing a story, I always outline my books before I write them, obviously, and have pretty detailed outlines, but the outlines never hold up throughout the story because you're in the process of writing it, and you're like, there's no way the character does this here, because if you put a lot of detail, flesh on the bones of the outline, things start to look a little bit different, and the same skills apply. You're kind of like now, you know, you thought your character, based on the outline, was going to turn left, but instead he's going straight, so how do you work in, you know, this transcendent moment of awesome that you had planned? Well, you know, for when you're running a role-playing game, so there you go. Everything I've ever needed to learn, I learned playing D&D.
The other thing that's really good for fantasy authors to take away from Dungeons & Dragons and Advanced Dungeons & Dragons is there's a balance to magic.
And that's
right. If you look at fantasy novels today, you can tell the people who were involved in some way, shape, or form with role-playing games in their youth. because their magic systems are logical, and there's a balance. There's a cost.
Yes, I think that's right.
Just to throw out there, one of the fun things that I did at one point was, you know, we had a very long campaign. My players did really well. I gave them essentially a celebration where they went to this town and they got drunk and they had a great time and they just tore the whole place up. And, then I said, okay, you know, you guys, you all going to sleep now, you're all drunk, all this kind of stuff. And, and then I said, okay, so you wake up the next morning, you're naked, all your money and gear's gone.
We actually have a running joke in our group about waking up naked, because this happened in the midst of a nightmare campaign one time with one of our DMs. So when things are going, like, anytime anything's going really bad and it just seems completely implausible, somebody will always say, you wake up naked, you hit the wall, because that's just what happened in this campaign. So it's become a stand-in for ridiculous events that make sense. Yours at least makes sense. Ours did not.
So there is, I'm going to throw this out there. This is not safe for work and it's not safe for kids. But when we're done with this podcast, go to Google and type in Farador, Farador.
Okay.
And this is a short film, and it's either French or Canadian, I'm not sure which. So it's not in English. There are subtitles. But it's basically about four guys who played Dungeons & Dragons in high school. And now they're all older, and one of them who hasn't seen them in a while decides to go in and play with them again. And it's very amusing. It's not safe for work. It is not safe for kids. It may not be safe for your wife to be standing over your shoulder while you're watching it.
Right.
But it is very amusing. John, do you have any last-minute questions before we start wrapping this up?
No, I noticed that we were getting down to the wire, so I think we could probably end there.
Well, Paul, why don't you tell people where they can find you on the web, what your website is, if you're on Twitter, when's your book coming out, all that kind of good stuff.
Okay, my website is Paul S. Kemp, that's KEMP.com. I am on Twitter at Paul S. Kemp. I'm on Facebook at Paul S. Kemp. And essentially, if you put in Paul S. Kemp, you'll find me in the various places that all writers essentially hang out these days on the internet.
Yep, I just clicked follow.
So there you go. Next book that's coming out is, as John mentioned, Deceived, in about a few weeks, which is a hardcover release from Del Rey about that ties into the Old Republic massive online role-playing game featuring Sith Lord Darth Malgus. And I hope people will check it out. It's one of those books that you don't need to have read a lot. You know, John didn't actually dig this book much, which kind of bums me out, because John normally does dig my work. And, you know, that happens sometimes.
I love your work, Paul. This one just did not sit well with me. But I'm going to relook at it before I release that review.
Absolutely no worries at all. That, you know, these things happen. You can't always hit a home run with every reader. But this is one of those where I think you don't necessarily need to know a lot about Star Wars expanded universe history to read it, because it's way before that stuff. So,
And for our listeners, there is a ton of expanded universe stuff out there that is just really awesome.
Yeah, no, there is. There's a lot of really, really good stuff out there. So anyway, that's it.
Any conventions, any appearances, any book signings?
I am appearing at the Chicago Entertainment Expo here at the end of the month. As we talked earlier with John Jackson Miller and an editor from Del Rey, I'll be doing a panel there on Friday, I believe, and I think I'll be doing a signing or two sandwiched around that somewhere. Other than that, I'm not sure. These are really real ad hoc for me, because I've got family and work and all. It's hard for me to do cons, frankly.
Understood. All right. Well, we thank you for coming on the podcast tonight. We really appreciate it.
Oh, yeah, really enjoyed it. John, nice to finally actually hear your voice and chat with you.
Yeah.
And Patrick, really, really enjoyed it. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Thanks to Paul for coming on the podcast and giving us a great conversation. We appreciate that, Paul. If you are interested in Paul's works, please visit paulskemp.com. He has links to all of his novels, his short stories, and where you can purchase them. He's also got a cool thing where you can order autographed copies of his works. And thank you to John Ottinger for coming on the podcast and taking the lead on that interview. We appreciate that. If you the listener, would like to be a part of this podcast, now is your chance. You can give us a call on the voicemail line. Tell us what you think. 720-277-9082. If that is a long-distance call for you and you don't want to make a long-distance call, just go to sfsignal.com. Click on a podcast post. There's a flash widget there, courtesy of Google. And if you plug in your number, Google will call you, saving you that dime, even though I know it costs more than a dime these days. If you enjoy this podcast, there's a couple other things you can do for us. Number one, you can tell a friend or two. You can go on iTunes, give us a couple stars, maybe write us a review. All these things help to boost our signal and our exposure on iTunes and get more listeners. Next week, we'll have another great topic and another great interview. Between then and now, feel free to visit sfsignal.com for tidbits and mind melds and all kinds of other cool stuff. You can follow John D. at twitter.com/sfsignal. That is the main feed on Twitter for sfsignal.com, and he links to all kinds of cool stuff all through the week. If you're looking for me, well, I'm on Twitter too, twitter.com/atfmb. That's all things from my brain. That's it for me, folks. I'm out of here. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Bye.